You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
So, welcome. Thanks for coming. We didn't give you much notice, and it's early in the morning, but we are very pleased that we have with us this week Freddy Pecciarelli from the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala. Freddy will present a slideshow which makes some of the connections between his forensic anthropology work and the search for truth and justice in Guatemala. Freddy has been a forensic anthropologist for 20 years, established the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala back in 1994, and his group is one of the three preeminent groups in Latin America and really internationally, because it's really been in Latin America that this work has been pioneering. He has one of the two labs in all of Latin America that are certified at the highest level of DNA matching analysis, and that means meeting with these international standards. The other lab is a Colombia state government lab. So his work is relevant not just for establishing the identities of people who have been missing for 20, 30 years, but he's also called upon by the current prosecutor to help to establish identities in modern day crimes. So Freddy, I will turn it over to you and look forward to hearing from you, and please supplement that introduction.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming to hear a little bit about our work in Guatemala. And thank you, Sandy, so much for this and everything else you do for the foundation and for the victims in Guatemala. I'd like to begin by looking at the issue of how we contribute to accountability a little bit. And tell you that what we do is provide technical expertise for the recovery and interpretation of physical forensic evidence. We have to understand what that means. You should maybe sit down. Because we've recently realized that although we also take testimonies, although we come across documents, our strength in the judicial system is to provide an interpretation of the physical evidence, and also referred to as real evidence, things you can touch that show what happened to that individual. We have so far conducted over 1,700 investigations and have presented, actually it's about 1,400 expert reports to the MP. MP is Ministerio Público, or the Attorney General's Office. The Attorney General's Office now, since Claudia Paz y Paz is the Attorney General, well, and probably till May, when she will no longer be the Attorney General, has supported their human rights office, their human rights section, quite a bit in these last 3.5 years. So now, for the first time since I've been back, I mean, I grew up in New York and I went back to Guatemala in 95. And for the first time since I've been there, we get requests from the prosecutor's office now, which is odd for us, because usually these cases were all pushed by organizations and families, and sometimes there had to be hunger strikes and marches, and they sort of had to force individual prosecutors into conducting these investigations. That is no longer the case. Now we get pressured by an entire office of prosecutors asking us for information, asking us for more exhumations, et cetera, to do pattern analysis now. Which is extremely fulfilling, and we're just hoping that it can continue. Among the cases that we presented evidence in is the genocide trial against General Rios Montt that occurred last year, where we presented evidence on 128 different cases, where we can see clear patterns of women, children, elderly being systematically massacred, as well as other patterns of violence, the way people were being killed. And I'll go into that in depth in a minute. 37 of FA of our experts presented these reports, and they dated back from exhumations carried out between 1998 all the way over to 2011, I think. And I'll explain to you. But the experience of that trial specifically has now led us to realize that more coordination is needed. The days before this case went to trial, the prosecutors found themselves in a panic, and so did we, because we weren't sure how the case was going to be presented. And one of the things that happened during the trial, which probably none of you noticed, was that of the witnesses that testified, none of them were from the communities where physical evidence was given. They were from the same area, but they were not from the same communities. So the physical evidence was not corroborating specific testimony. It was generalized. And it worked because the defense strategy was not in the courtroom. The defense strategy was being played in the political arena at a different level. And getting a conviction, well, they figured they could probably get it stopped before it happened. But if it did happen, well, there was other things they can do. In the future, we don't believe that's going to work, and we need to coordinate better. And we have the witnesses, we have the physical evidence, we have the documents. There is no reason why these can't be presented in an orderly, coordinated fashion, so that everyone can understand what happened at each one of these places, which is, you know, important for each individual, not only each community. The forensic experts, now we're pushing for this, should actively assist prosecutors in building the legal case. Now, this means not only conducting the exhumation and then being called to testify 10 years later, but actively maintain communication during that time, so then together we can develop a strategy and give the information to the prosecution of which way they can go with this. There is a direct link between the types of evidence. This goes back to what I was telling you, testimonial, documentary, and physical evidence. And we should be looking for patterns. And the images that you see here are actually, you know, ropes that are used, in, for example, in the Achi region of Guatemala, which is Baja Verapaz or Rabinal. There is, we now see a tendency to use ropes, garrotes, basically ropes with a stick behind them that are used to crush a person's neck and dislocate the axis and causing death. But we see it more in that region than any other region. We also see the killing being conducted more and more for longer periods of time by civil patrolmen, which is different than what we see in the Ishil. The Ishil, we see a peak in 1982, and then it goes down. In this area of Guatemala, we see massacre after massacre after massacre. Now we can tell that these are tied to empowering these civil patrolmen to also enforce the movement of the communities along the area where the water dam was going to be built. So there is a pattern that we have to look for, and also the patterns of trauma that I can show you in the video. Now, we have to understand that what we are now getting from all this evidence is we can now see planning, we can see specific counterinsurgency operations, we can see control tactics, we can see actual enforced disappearances, extrajudicial executions, torture. And this is something that the entire set of evidence gives you, not only the physical evidence. Now, although the FAFG has conducted over 1,700 forensic investigations during the past 20 years, it is really important that you understand that only 15 cases have made it to trial. This is an image of taken during the Rios Montt trial. Now, of those 10 cases, forensic evidence was only used in 10 of them. When we explore who was tried during these cases, we realize that only in 6 of those cases, which is the Miramar case, Chamang, El Jute, Fernando Garcia, Dos Serres, and Rios Montt, involve members of the Guatemalan Army. The other trials only involve civil patrolmen or military commissioners. So really, it's only 6 out of over 1,700 that involve military officers of some kind. The level of impunity for human rights violations committed during Guatemala's internal armed conflict is almost absolute. Statistically, we can say that only 0.88% of the investigations have reached a trial stage. That's less than 1%. to put this into perspective, and when we look at the commission information, the Historical Clarification Commission identified 669 massacres. Out of those, they attributed 629 to the military or state agencies. Only four of those 629 have made it to trial. And this is if you exclude the cases used in the genocide trial, because, again, they were used so they were so disorganized that none of them actually mattered in themselves. But it's important that we understand that those are cases of massacres. Now, when we look at enforced disappearances, which is very different, and I'll explain to you how different they are, only five cases of enforced disappearances have made the trial. Edgar Paredes Chegüen, Edgar Sainz Calito, Fernando Garcia, El Jute, and Chuatalum. The lack of forensic evidence and the very limited number of identifications of these bodies of victims of this type of crime have made it almost impossible to take these cases to crime. So a lot of these cases, for example, the Fernando Garcia case, was based more than anything on documentary evidence that came from the National Police Archive, which is great, but it will give you very limited information about all of the people that were disappeared, or a larger majority disappeared. We have, in the last year or so, conducted 130 identifications of victims of enforced disappearance that could not have been possible without the DNA database. These are identifications of people who were believed to be in one place, and we found their body in another place. I mean, there is no way we could have found these people without DNA. None. So far, 130 and growing. And then growing because the DNA database is growing. And you need to have both things. You need to have the DNA profiles of the skeletons, and you need to have the DNA profiles of the families, of the right family members at that. And when you cross those, you might get a probability of identification. Now, that's very different than what you saw here in New York in the World Trade Center. In the World Trade Center, what you saw was direct identifications, identifications through direct matching DNA, but people were home the day before. So you can go back and take samples, their own samples, from their brushes, from their clothing, from their beds, it's from their toothbrushes, etc. So that's sort of like when a rape case is done, you have the perpetrator's profile, and it's either it is that person or not. There is no probability. It's the same exact profile or it isn't. With this type of matching, it's kinship analysis, we are figuring out how probable it is that this individual belongs within this family. And what that does is it creates the obstacle of having to have the right family members. So what we're looking for are parents, siblings, or children. And then we can, with a very high level of certainty, tell you we are sure with a number, usually in the billions, sometimes in the trillions, and if we're not too sure, in the millions, but we can say this individual belongs to this family and is likely that he belongs there 23 billion more times than if this happened by chance. And that's pretty strong evidence. I mean, it's not 100%. DNA evidence will never be 100%. But there's a lot of nines after the 99. And the longer the nines get, the more certain the DNA analysts are. Because I consider myself a human identification specialist now, although I'm a forensic anthropologist, kind of have to learn what you can take from each one of these different disciplines to get the identifications. Because in the end, what's important is the identification. I mean, the important is to be able to give this body back to the family. It makes all the difference in the world. And this is an example. This is when I say empowerment, this is what I mean. This is all the way in the back, the gentleman in the tie, his name is Esther Villatoro. The second lady is his wife. No, well, it's his mother. It's Nestor's mother, the victim's wife. His name is Amancio Villatoro. Now, Amancio Villatoro was a labor leader in Guatemala and was killed. He was captured on January 30th, 1984, and was held in captivity for 57 days before he was executed. Now, I know this because he is one of the people that show up in the military diary. I don't know if you know what the military diary is. It's a document that depicts, it was taken from a secret military archive, sort of smuggled out and given to Kate Doyle and of the National Security Archive. The original is here in Washington, D.C., and it has six sections. Actually, this is all in the presentation later, but in the end, it shows individual following, individual targeting, and has pictures. And it says, you know, in Amancio's case, even the nicknames and how much he used to get paid, and what was, you know, these are people that were identified as internal enemies of the state. But then it also says 300, which before I knew it, meant executed. So when we looked at the document, we realized that he was executed on that day. We found him in a military base 2 hours away from the city, although he was captured in the city. Nestor was the only one of his family who made it to the United States. They were supported by the Coca-Cola union in Guatemala to take him out of Guatemala and get him to the States. But he was the only one that made it across. And then the mother and the three other children went back to Guatemala. They couldn't make it across. Nestor worked in the railroad, and eventually, well, now he's a union leader. He's with the nurses union, I think the largest and strongest in the country, according to him. And he's his father. He's his father's son. When we told his mother, his wife, Amancio's wife and Nestor's mother, the other children, which are now, you know, one's a doctor and Samuel is a restaurant owner and a daughter, all four of them, said, listen, we found your father. Their reaction was a bit, I mean, I was expecting more emotion. They were shocked. And then when we asked them, listen, are you going to go public with this? And the doctor asked, does the current president have anything to do with my father's disappearance? And I said, you know what? I don't know. So he said, because if he does, we don't want to go public. And I was disappointed, but it's their choice. 3 or 4 days later, Nestor comes from the States. And we have to go through the whole process. And he asked, can I see my father's body? Of course. And he goes, but before you show it to me, tell me one thing. Did he have a metal tooth, a silver tooth around here? And I'm like, you know what? I haven't personally seen the body, but let me check. He goes, because about a week before he died, he got a silver cap put on a tooth, and he showed it to me, and he told me, if I ever go missing, maybe you can identify me with this. And it was there. It's huge. And we didn't take it into consideration for identification because no one had reported it. He's identified nonetheless because of many other things, but I thought that was very special. When we sat down and spoke to Nestor, and I asked him, do you know what you're going to do and when you're going to bury your father? And he slammed the table and said, we're never going to bury my father. He's been hidden in the ground for 28 years, and we're never going to put him back in the ground. I didn't know what to do with that. I mean, nobody's ever said that to me. So I said, so what are you going to do? We want to put him in a glass coffin, and we want to create a museum and have him speak, him tell his own story to people. And then I opened my big mouth. Well, maybe you could do it at the foundation. In the meantime, while you guys get the museum going, you know, since we have custody of the body, you can do it here. About 2 weeks later, they had plans to change our garage into a temporary museum. And this is the temporary museum. This is the day it opened. And it's going on its third year now. They've had the first year 3,000 visitors, last year 4,000 visitors, and growing. And this family is completely changed. When you see Amancio's wife now, she looks like a different woman, completely. And it was interesting that his other brother, when he gave a talk, started by saying, I will try to explain to you what it's like to have someone in your family disappeared, but the truth is that you will never understand. And I started thinking, because no matter what I tell you, you would only know what it feels like if you go through it. And we don't want you to go through it, so you will never understand. But in his case, his father went missing. His father was taken when he was 8 years old. And he said, I don't know what to do anymore with myself now. the last 20 years of my life, all I've done is look for my father. Now that I found him, I didn't know what to do. But now he's found something. He's running the Amancio Villatoro Foundation and this museum. But this is what we mean when we're talking about empowerment. And that's why we're not talking about closure so much anymore. The types of evidence, again, the personal experience, which is, you know, when you bring in an expert that although hasn't handled the evidence itself, can tell you more or less contextual information that might have played a role. And this was used in the genocide trial. They brought in a couple of experts to speak about racism in Guatemala and things of the sort, military operations of some kind, testimonial, which is when the victims literally get the witnesses and victims and speak about things they saw, documentary, which again, the documents which you can see there. This is just one of the rooms of many, many rooms and 80 million documents that the National Police Archive contains. And then the physical evidence, the scientific physical evidence. And on one side we have the sample that's being taken. That's Julio. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. We take a DNA sample by using a buccal swab. So we only rub the inside of the mouth. We don't take blood because it's difficult to take blood in Guatemala. A lot of people work with their hands, and sometimes it's, you know, even though you try to get it from their fingers, they have very thick working skin, and it's just difficult. So this is less intrusive. Plus, there's the whole cultural aspect of the blood. And so buccal swabs are working fine. That's Oscar there, working on a skull, analyzing it. And that's Marco and Monica in the DNA lab processing some bones. So let's get back to this trial. That's me. And in the background, as General Rios-Montt, who I only realized was there when I was almost finished, because this is a big figure in Guatemalan history. And there was a lot of weight of being in the same room with him. And what we presented, Claudia and I presented, was an analysis of 114 different cases of the region. And now the region, this is Quiché as a whole, but the Ishil area is comprised of three municipalities, Nevaj, Chajul, and Cotzal. The prosecution asked us to focus on specific dates, which were from March 23rd, 1982, which was when he came into office, Rios-Montt, till October 21st, 1983, which was not when he left office, but was when his Minister of Defense left office, who couldn't stand trial because of health issues, but when they requested his report, they forgot to change the dates. So there could have been an argument made there, but it wasn't. Overall, when we started looking at the region, we had to start from somewhere, so we started from our universe, right? At the time. So we said, okay, 1,116 cases in Guatemala, 5,810 skeletal remains recovered, 94.23% of those recovered in five departments. Petén, 257 bodies, Alta Verapaz, 300. This has changed dramatically because we worked in a case in Alta Verapaz, one case of a military base where we recovered 533 bodies, which are not counted here. Baja Verapaz, 774. Chimaltenango, 1175. And Quiché, overwhelmingly the majority, 670 cases and close to 3,000 bodies. Now, this is also very consistent with what the Truth Commission says. The Truth Commission says that 52% of the violations and of the assassinations or executions occurred in Quiché. And this is almost, actually, of this sample, it's probably a little more, but it's about 50% of our caseload. It's in Quiché. Then we looked at the cases specifically within the Ishil area. Of the 670 cases in Quiché, 314 were in Ishil, where we recovered 1,179 skeletonized remains. Of those 314, we excluded 200 cases because they did not fall within the period, the time frame that we were asked to look at. So that left us with 114 cases and 420 bodies. And this was our process, our thought process, how to go through, how do we get to where they want us to go? And we had to go through the entire country to get here. Now, a total of, we had, now this is important, One thing is the number of bodies you have. The other thing is the number of reported victims you have. One set of information comes from the families. The other set of information comes from the graves. And then you match that. Well, this information here is from the families. We had a total of 448 victims reported in those cases. Among them, 150 sub-adults, children. And these are the ages. NON, which is unborn, fetuses, right? Then you have infants, 0 to 3, et cetera, et cetera. But you can look at the children, 4 to 12, and it's a very high number, 67. Well, actually, 0 to 12 is 130. So it's a very large percentage. Then we look at the remains. 420 remains recovered from a total of 227 graves in those 114 investigations. Now, it just so happened that, I mean, there's many more bodies, but those are the ones that fell into that time frame because, again, this was a mistake. If they would have proposed it a little differently, they could have included many, many more victims. But they wanted to be careful because a lot of times when people aren't sure of the dates, we had to exclude the cases, right? So that's a lesson because you have to understand that within Mayan culture, the dates are not that important. I mean, our dates are not that important. So they related to other things like when is, you know, harvesting of specific crops and things of the sort, but not specifically to dates. So we had to be careful with that.
But how easy is it for you to determine the date?
The date is not determined by the evidence. The date is determined by the testimony. We're actually working with the Smithsonian Institute right now to run some tests on how radiation is seen in remains and measured that can give us more specific dates, basically through carbon-14 dating, based on the radiation absorbed by all of us after the nuclear testing. So what we're waiting for is a skeleton from 1963, which is the peak, so it can serve as the basis for how everything else goes down within Guatemala. So, but that's being done, and it probably takes some years to develop. In the meantime, we have to... Documentary evidence is helping a lot, and testimonial evidence has been the basis for it. So, yes, if we were questioned in the courtroom, how certain are you of this specific date, I would have to say there is a degree of uncertainty because it is based on a family's testimony. You have to ask them how certain they were. Of the individuals that were exhumed, close to 36% were ages 0 to 17. Here go the ages. We can go a little faster. Of the total we looked at, there was 338 wounds observed in 157 individuals. There was a total of 162 gunshot wounds. Achapaf is gunshot wounds, so herida proyectil de arma de fuego, male, female, undetermined. There was other contuso, which is blunt force. Corto contundente, which is usually the way we see it in Guatemala, is a sharp instrument with some weight, which is a machete, usually in Guatemala. Punzo cortante is stab wounds, and undetermined. 64.20% or 104% of the gunshot wounds were observed to be in the head, or 29 or 17.90% to the thorax. In total, 75% of the traumas were located in the head or thorax. Now, this is important because there was a question that the prosecution asked about can we determine if these wounds of these people were killed in combat or in execution. Now, this is important because there's always been the claim that these are guerrilla fighters fighting, and you know, if you get killed with a weapon while you're fighting, well, it's legal. It's within the rules of law. You can kill somebody if they're shooting at you in a war. It's legal. You won't get prosecuted for that. So we decided to look at a study conducted by my old friend Clyde Snow. Dr. Clyde Snow had looked at 25 different combats during the last 60 years. And that's the chart. And what he looked at was the frequency of fatal gunshot wounds in combat. Now, what this meant is if you're in a combat, what is the probability that you're going to die from a wound? And the number is, out of those 25 combats during 60 years, 0.199%, or 2 out of 10, pretty much. So 2 out of 10 wounds in a combat will kill you. That's pretty good odds. If you're worried about getting killed in a war, just don't have bad luck and be the 20%, right? So it was difficult for us to do that because how do we divide that? Everyone we have is dead. I mean, they're all dead. So let's look. What I decided to do was look at the gunshot wounds, only at the gunshot wounds, and exclude everyone else. So we looked at the 107 gunshot wounds, and then I separated them between the gunshot wounds that I believe could be fatal and the ones that, if treated, would probably also be fatal, but let's say that they could have been saved. So the fatal gunshot wounds were 89 in the region, and non-fatal, 18. Now, of those 89, there was 15 that had multiple gunshot wounds, which, messes things up a little bit. But overall, when we did the frequency of gunshot wound ratio to this, it was 0.831, or 83%. And the study itself says anything over 20, it should be suspicious. Something four times over 20 indicates that this is definitely not something that can happen in combat. We looked at a binomial distribution to do this, and basically we used the theory of, let's say this was a dice. If you throw a dice 107 times, what is the probability that you will get number one 89 times? Out of those, that's basically the odds for it. And the number we came up with was this. This is the probability that if you throw a dice 107 times, you'll hit one 89 times, which is a very, very, very small number. I mean, ridiculously small. It's like DNA. You can't say 100%. Here, you really can't say zero or no chance. But really, you can probably try it millions and billions of times, and you won't get 89 ones out of 107 dice rolls. So basically, this did not happen in combat. It happened during an execution. It had to be a planned operation with targeted areas. In other words, you shoot in the head and in the thorax to kill someone specifically with the purpose of executing them. It doesn't happen by chance, is what it's saying. And this was the testimony that was presented in court. And this, I believe, was very strong in proving that these were not combat deaths. And as Forrest Gump would say, that's all I have to say about that. If I can continue, being a little more general now, we can talk a little bit about Guatemala in general. 65% of the population lives in rural areas. Still, 52. The number oscillates between who you ask. If you ask the rich and powerful, they'll say 40% of the population is indigenous. If you ask the indigenous, they'll probably say 60%. We think it's around 51-52% still. And this is difficult to ascertain because it's cultural identity as well. And because of the conflict and racism, sometimes people choose not to say what their cultural ethnicity is, what their ethnicity is. They just say Ladino. But they just would rather, instead of saying Achi or Ishil. This is a map that shows you more or less the different areas where the different Mayan languages are spoken. And here, well, the Ishil among the Achi, Chokti, and the others are the ones that were targeted and are the ones that Rios Montt is accused of committing genocide in this trial. It doesn't mean that there won't be other trials. It doesn't mean that he won't be accused of other genocides. But the Ishil is the original one. Now, the Truth Commission said there was about 200,000 victims, among them 160,000 dead and about 40,000 disappeared, about 11% children. 1.5 million displaced, 83% of the Mayan of the victims were Mayan civilians, and 17% was Ladino civilians or Ladino internal enemies of the state viewed as guerrillas, but not captured or killed during combat, but captured and killed in their home at midnight or leaving their job or leaving school or whatever. They also determined that there were 669 massacres, and they defined the massacre as an event where, in a single event, five or more people were killed. And this was the definition of the CEH. Most of the killings and most of the crimes occurred between 1980 and 84, 82 being the worst year by far. And soon, if you go to our webpage, which I wouldn't go now because it's ugly, but it will soon be much better, you will find an orange button at the very top that says Base de Datos, and you'll be able to click on that button and you'll be able to see all of our cases, all of the reported victims, which will be over 12,000 names and everything, all of the skeletons we've exhumed and all of the people we've identified. And that should be online within the next month or so. And everyone will be able to see that. And that's we're very proud of being able to do that. But this is a map that shows where the counterinsurgency operations were focused. And if you look at the map, there seems to be a little consistency in the areas between the Mayan highlands and the indigenous, where the indigenous, most of the indigenous population lived, and where the operations were centered. Obviously, you would need a military expert to tell you the reasoning behind that, but to me, in simple view, it looks like they were targeting red zones, basically. We came about because of the need to do this work, because people went missing, people got killed, and families started looking for them. And they heard, family groups heard, that there was this American, old American guy who had done something similar in Argentina, Dr. Clyde Snow, whom you see here, who is still alive. He's in Norman, Oklahoma. He's a great friend and mentor, and has, I don't think I've ever taken an important decision without consulting with Clyde. He has become, everything. A friend and somebody who's literally sat next to me and thought about what else we can do, because we always felt like we weren't doing enough. Well, he was sent down to Argentina by the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, eventually to Chile in 87, and then he made it to Guatemala in 90, and then back in 91, and then in 92, and then in 92 the team was formed, the Guatemalan Forensic Anthropology team. Then we formed the foundation in 97, and Clyde has been there every step of the way. Let's continue with this. We are an NGO, non-governmental organization. We consider ourselves scientists. I've been struggling with saying we're not human rights activists, but I will stop now. You have to be this work. You can't continue doing this work, and you could still be a scientist, and you can still be objective, but there has to be a focus on human rights. There has to be a focus on gender issues. There has to be a focus on indigenous peoples. There has to be a focus on children. There has to be. There's no way of doing this work without there being that. And the idea here is to strengthen Guatemala's state institutions, to begin to create trust in those state institutions with the hope of eventually reaching some type of reconciliation or democratization in places like Guatemala. And this, it's a very long process, and obviously this is done by identifying people. The cases that we work on mostly are armed conflict deaths, now a lot more on armed conflict and forced disappearances, sometimes, not often, but sometimes on mass disasters, like landslides and things of the sort. And more often than before, we get asked by prosecutors, like Sandy mentioned, to look at current cases and help out, because of our DNA capacity and our archaeology capacity, to help out with rapes usually, or homicides that are very complicated or that are of high impact, and that they're afraid that there might be some political implications or drug lord implications, then they call us. That's wonderful. It is actually. It's something that we are working on more and more. Well, the objectives really are to provide dignity for the families through the identification. But what we've realized, before we used to say closure, like I told you, it's not closure, it's empowerment of people. It's also contributing to creating trust within the legal system by strengthening the legal institutions and the actual judges and prosecutors to train them and teach them what forensic evidence is and how to use it and how to understand it. And also to write the historical record through science. And, you know, my son had a class last year. He was a sophomore in high school last year. And he had a class in public presentations or something. And they had to do a PowerPoint, something like this, as a final project. Well, he did his on breast implants. And I was like, okay, way to go, Tristan. And he was really upset because after he presented, a girl made a presentation. And the title of the presentation was Why There Was No Genocide in Guatemala. And in the class, and she presented the whole thing, and it's basically the opposite of what I'm presenting. And her final statement was, you know, thank God that the army saved us because the guerrilla was massacring everyone in the towns, and if it wasn't for the army coming in there and saving all of these towns from the guerrilla, they would have ended everything. And my son was so upset that he recorded some of this for me so he can show me. And then I think he was a little embarrassed that he did his breast implants. Not that breasts are any less important, but I think he got it finally, and he was really upset. Now, what I'm surprised at is that the teacher said nothing. The school said nothing. No one said anything. And it, you know, we can't have that going on in the schools and the teachers being so afraid of saying something because probably the girl's father is some colonel or general. However, I get one of my daughter's friends who's studying in a private school in Virginia, and he, I don't know where the message is now, but he wrote to my daughter saying, we were learning about massacres in Guatemala and they mentioned your father. And I said, oh my God, I know him. And he was very proud of the fact that in that school in Virginia, I don't know, some private school in Virginia, they were talking about Guatemala and about the work that's being done very differently. And it just, I think it's great that it's happening in some places, but it's a shame that it's not happening in Guatemala permanently. And it's not happening in Guatemala. Well, the types of documentation we spoke a little bit about, the importance of physical evidence. I'll go through quickly on how the foundation is divided, more or less, and how we do what we do. Well, one of the things is victims investigations, and we use cultural anthropologists, criminologists, psychologists to engage the families, engage the survivors, talk to them, take their DNA samples, create trust, basically. The work is based on this. If we don't have the trust of the families, we have nothing. Because all the forensic evidence you want will give you nothing unless you have something to compare it to. So our role is to create that trust that would eventually lead to passing that trust on to the prosecutor's office, which has been easier with a prosecutor like Claudia Pasipas than in the past, and we hope it will continue to be easy in the future, but we don't know. And then come the other guys, you know, the archaeologists that recover the bodies, the forensic anthropologists that analyze them, and the geneticists that look at the DNA. Quickly, this is what I mean. We have, usually when we go into a community, we have sessions like this where we explain exactly the way I'm explaining it to you, to the families. It's important that they know what they're going to encounter. It's important that they know what they're going to see. A lot of these families have not told these stories to anyone. They have not relived what happened, and they will relive what happened as soon as we open those graves, and they do. It's very emotional. Sometimes, as you can see in the bottom, there's ceremonies, and the ceremonies usually are to ask permission of Mother Earth to let us dig in the soil. The other is to ask of the dead that they let us find them and will not harm us. And the other is a ceremony of cleansing. They need to cleanse us to allow us to look for the dead. So these ceremonies are not allowed. These ceremonies are part of it. All of our people know that if a community wants to do this, we stop and it's done. It's not a matter of permission. It's not a matter of allowance. It's a matter of they have the right to do it. And we respect that right, and we participate. What we're looking for here is what occurred. where are the bodies, the number of victims, and the name of the victims, right? The antemortem biological profile of the victims, what they look like, whether they're a man or a woman, how old, how tall. Genealogy of the victims, how was a family tree? I mean, what did the family relations look like? And obviously taking the family reference sample, which would be important. And what you can see here, this is an actual case. This is the case of a family in Dos Erres, the massacre of Dos Erres, which occurred on the 6th, 7th, and 8th of December of 1982. It was committed by 21 Special Forces soldiers of the military, Caibiles. They're the highest trained soldiers in Guatemala. They are trained killers, and they're notoriously known for that all over the world. They went into this town with the excuse that this town, there was guerrillas in this town, and they had taken some rifles. They had stolen some rifles from the military, and the perpetrators were in this town. So they went in there, and during those 3 days, they raped the women. They executed 201 people, including many, many children, and they threw them in a well. And they did it mostly by hand. They did it with a sledgehammer. They would take a sledgehammer and break people's skulls right at the edge of the well and throw them into the well. Sometimes this, during the testimony, there was talk of throwing a grenade either on a pile of bodies or down the well. There was some shooting, but mostly it was done through blunt force trauma. Among those were the family of Tranquilino Castañeda. He believed his wife, who's up top, that's his wife up top, his 2, 4, 6 daughters and 3 children were killed. Now, I say 3 children because he believed that Oscar was also killed. So he gave the testimony, 10 people in his family. Now, it wasn't till 2 of the perpetrators spoke and they mentioned there was 2 children taken by soldiers. They were taken by officers from the site. They weren't killed. They were taken. One of those children was Oscar Ramirez. He was taken by the sub-commander, Oscar Ramirez, and taken home and given to his mother and said, listen, this is my son. You need to help me bring him up. And his mother doesn't want anything to do with him or she's dead. And that's it. He was part of the family. He was white, green eyes. He might be here somewhere. And that's the abductive father. That's Oscar. In Framingham, Massachusetts, the prosecution traced him down through his, at the time, girlfriend, now wife, who they called La Flaca. So they went into this town asking for La Flaca, and somebody said, La Flaca lives over there. La Flaca means a skinny one. It's just like a... And they went to the house and they called, and La Flaca was living in Framingham, Massachusetts. So they called, and Oscar was there, and he didn't believe any of this, but eventually they asked me to go up to Framingham, take the sample to see if this could be, the 2 boys could be related. The other boy is living in Canada, and the living father. Eventually we did identify him. This is the father, the biological father, Don Tranquilino. They met last year in Newark Airport, out of all places, on May 28th. He is biologically his son. The story has been confirmed. And since then, Oscar was very worried because he was an undocumented immigrant at the time. Since then, our good friend, who might walk through the door any second now, Scott Greathead, has represented him in his... asylum application, and he was granted asylum last year, and has now been traveling around the country with us, speaking about what happened to the Guatemalan community. And as recently as February, we were in Riverside, California, for the sentencing of one of the perpetrators, who was tried here in the United States for lying on his naturalization application, and he was sentenced to 10 years. His name was Sosa Orantes, and he was one of the perpetrators. And Oscar spoke to the judge right before sentencing, and he got the maximum, which was 10 years for lying on an application is a long time. So that's Oscar, and that's his dad. I mean, when we saw them together, I was like, you don't need DNA. But So that's what the anthropologists, the investigators do. Then forensic archaeology is what you expect. You know, I had a professor of archaeology, Professor Oshkin Schlager, at Brooklyn College, who said, Freddie, if you ever want to leave a mark in this world, dig a hole. Why dig a hole? Well, the earth has taken millions of years to compact to a certain level and to separate, the strata separate. So when you dig a hole, a trained eye can tell where you dug a hole. And that's where archaeologists are. They're very highly trained to be able to find these holes. And in Guatemala, these holes happen to be filled with bodies in their graves. But they document everything along the way, right? Because this all has to be recreated for the families and for trials of judges and prosecutors eventually. And you can see here, hands tied behind the back. Sometimes these graves are very complex, large. Here you see again the stick with the rope. It's used in many parts of the country, but specifically one. Other larger graves. Some archaeological drawings to help us understand positions better. Photographs, etc. Eventually, the bodies are exhumed and taken to the lab, where we are really looking to do two things. Individualize each skeleton and also understand how the person died. Individualize it in the sense of, was it a man or a woman? How old they were, how tall they were. Did they suffer any antemortem trauma during life that would help us separate them or isolate them in a way that we can compare it to less number of victims? If we're looking for, let's say, we're looking for 100, but only 30 were women, and we have a woman skeleton, it might be 1 to 30. But if we're looking for a 15-year-old, and this one was between 14 and 20, or 14 and 18, then we might say, okay, how many 15-year-olds? 5. It might be 1 in 5. That would help us narrow down who we're looking for. And obviously, trauma analysis. Here you can see machete wounds. And over here, this is an entrance gunshot wound. This is an exit gunshot wound. We can see trajectory sometimes, a bullet coming from the top, again at the bottom. Children, a lot of children between the ages of 4 to 12 have gunshot wounds to the head. And I have a theory for that, and that's that the smaller children you can just take by the arms and legs and smash them against a tree or a boulder. As it is done in most countries throughout history. Cambodia was infamous for this, Guatemala is infamous for this. But the older children, I mean, before 12, you can't really use them for much. They just run around and they're, so you have to shoot them. The older ones you can, you know, take in, force them to be soldiers and do something, force them to be slaves or whatever, but the 4 to 12-year-olds, they're very difficult. And there's a very high incidence of gunshot wounds to the head in that age range. We look at the clothing as well to make sure, because you can't, if somebody's clothed, you can't shoot them without going through the clothing. You can't stab them without going through the clothing. So it's important to look at the clothing just to keep matching things up. And then eventually we get to the forensic genetics, which is, again, comparing the DNA profiles of the family, so the DNA profiles of the bones or the teeth, right? This is our DNA lab, and we get a profile that we then put into the Genetic National Data Bank, and which is, by the way, as Sandy mentioned, our lab is accredited under Rule ISO 17025-2005. ISO is the International Standardization Organization. This is an international rule, set of rules. It's a very, very high standard of accreditation. There's only two labs that have this level of accreditation. There are forensic laboratories that can work with human bones to extract DNA. And we have one of the labs. And we did this on purpose because we wanted to make sure that this evidence could not be challenged because of the doubt in the science that we're using. And it cannot. But at the same time, what it has created, which is I also thought about, that I hope they create this, is competition with the state lab. The state lab wants it, so we created the DNA lab, said, well, if they did it, we can do it. And they did. But their lab is not accredited. So when we've testified in recent cases, the judges believe us instead of them because we're accredited. So now they see a need in becoming accredited, and they're asking for help, which is wonderful. And we're working together to accredit them. Quickly, we take a sample. Here it's blood, although I say we don't take blood, but we can do blood. We can do any sample, any. We can even do cigarette butts. We take the sample, then we extract the DNA. We eventually multiply it, and then once it's multiplied through a polymerase chain reaction, we put it into our genetic analyzers, which are these big, expensive, really expensive machines. That what they do is they channel, separate the DNA according to size, and then zap it with a laser so we can see the difference. And that's all that happens. It gets put into the machine, and then it gets separated by size and zapped with this laser, and then we get a profile. It's a little more complicated than just that, but these are the locations when we're looking at. We're looking at 16 different locations in the human genome. We're looking at nuclear DNA. That means it comes from the mother and the father. And we're looking at this DNA because it's the one that gives us the most identifiable information. In other words, it helps us to identify someone. There's also mitochondrial DNA that's passed down through women, but that gives us lineage more than individualization. There's also Y chromosome DNA that's passed down to the fathers. But again, it doesn't give us that level of specificity that we need. This type of profile, this STR profile of these 16 regions, is unique to each individual. No one in the world will have one exactly like yours unless you have an identical twin. They will have an identical profile to you. Then all of those numbers get imported. And you know, they look at it'll look like this, you know, in location D8S1179, you have two codes, 13 repetitions and 14 repetitions. One comes from your mother, one comes from your father. That's pretty much what that's saying. And then we put that into the data bank, and what the data bank does is it compares the skeleton profiles and tries to see if they fit within a family. And then it gives us probabilities of fitting in there. This is how we take it. The way we invite people is through a campaign called My Name Is Not XX. Is not Dos Equis, the beer. Mm-hmm. XX in Guatemala actually means John Doe or Jane Doe. In the rest of Latin America, they use NN. Here we use XX. NN is used for stillbirths or no nacido, unborn. And what we do is we ask people, we tell people, you know, my name is not XX, your DNA can identify me. Now this has changed over time, and then later it became, if you have a family member who's disappeared between 1960 and 96, call 1598, which is a hotline. And then with DNA, we're identifying them. Unfortunately, I don't have the latest one, which is now families of the people that we've identified are saying, we have found them. And it's their images in the latest campaign. The way a case gets to us is that families go to legal NGOs who then pressure the public ministry. They come to us, and then we go with mental health organizations back to the community. This is what I was saying. In the past, if they didn't want to do it, this is what would happen. You have to do it, and they would. Now that's changed. One last thing. Closed context cases against open context cases. Closed context cases, is now that flight 239, is it? No, 239 is the number of people. I don't know the number of the flight. 370. Flight 370 went missing. We can use that example. There was 239 passengers, plus the crew. If they find it, did they find it? Not yet. I'm a little lost. I've been flying, right? For identification purposes, that is a closed context scenario. If they ever find the flight and the remains of the people that were in the flight, we will be looking at a comparison of one body to the number of passengers, 1 to 239. And then we'll separate how many men, how many women, the ages, and then we can get down to... But you pretty much know who was there. You have the identification of the group. That's what the massacres are. The massacres, there was a lot of witnesses. We know who's there. We know where they're buried. We know who killed them. We know a lot of things. In those cases, we need less DNA because there's a lot of information. The open context cases, on the other hand, are cases of enforced disappearances, like military bases where we go dig and we find hundreds of skeletons. We have no idea who they are. And on the other hand, we have reports of hundreds or thousands of people missing, but we have no idea where their bodies are. And that's where we need more DNA. And that's important because... without that, we wouldn't be able to do anything in this sense. And remember what I said, only 5 cases of enforced disappearance have made it to trial. So if you want, we can stop there for questions, and if you want to continue, I have more.
Great. Well, fascinating. And, you know, I had thought that I would interrupt after half an hour, but I must say that the slides tell such a story. It's so compelling. But I do want to give people a chance for questions. I've got a few, and let's start. Alex.
Hi, my name is Alexander. Thank you for coming. This is very educational. That's excellent. I was wondering, at the beginning you mentioned that it was families that pushed your work at the beginning, and now it's more official offices, governmental offices. What changed there? And also, what kind of challenges do you face in your work due to, I mean, it's not too recent, but it's pretty recent. Like, say, for example, it's stuff that's been done by the military. Is there danger still? Is there, you know, stuff like that?
Do people have any related questions? Okay. Ready.
The challenges. The biggest challenge, believe it or not, is fundraising. That is the biggest problem we have. Because since we've incorporated DNA, each one of these machines that are actually about to run out of use because they changed technology cost about $200,000. So it costs about $1 million just to change all the equipment, for example. We have over 100 staff members working on interviewing families. So funding is probably our biggest challenge. We were funded for a very long time by governments, Swedish government, the US government, and the government of the Netherlands through UNDP for about 10 years. But in the last year or so, the Netherlands closed their embassy and left. The USAID says that if it's not gang-related or drug-related, they can't fund it. And the Swedish will probably continue, but at a lower level. So we have now had to create a new sustainability strategy to try to see how we continue, because as I was telling Sandy, this is not so much about the existence of the organization, but the process. This is important. This is changing Guatemala one family at a time, one community at a time. And I believe that this will have a large, large impact soon. It's already having a very large impact, but the more people that we identify, the more that families make links to each other, the more they start talking, the more they go into the streets, the more they request their rights. And it's, for me, the beginning of a movement, something like Argentina, hopefully someday. Now it's not the case in Guatemala. Now, the other question was what do we attribute the change to? We attribute it to Claudia Paz y Paz, to the Attorney General. The difference is she has instructed the offices to, or her prosecutors, to move, to do something. You know, we've been investigating these cases for 20 years. The evidence is there. It's been there all along. And it's not till the last 3.5 years that something has been done. Now, obviously, Claudia Paz y Paz is not alone. She's got a team. She's got people that support her. She has people in the, she doesn't have. The country has people in the justice system that are also good, like the magistrate Barrientos that unfortunately committed suicide only a couple of weeks ago. And he was one of the people that also helped change the country, but unfortunately he committed suicide a couple of weeks ago. But it's those individuals that are setting the example and daring to change the country. Is there an obstacle from the military itself? No. The government, usually what they do is just ignore us in every sense of the word. So they don't acknowledge our existence in any way. So there's no public recognition for the work. There's no awards. There's no visiting the sites. There's no funding. We don't exist. And now, in this military base, this one specifically, the commanders, when they were interviewed by the press and asked, listen, there's hundreds of bodies showing up there, what do you have to say about it? Oh, that's normal. There was hundreds of people that used to work there and live there. And as they would die, they would get buried naturally. So that's why they're there. And I'll show you the pictures and you tell me if these are natural burials. Natural, I don't know what even natural means, but even that's like a racist term for. But it's just, they continue to play it like nothing ever happened. And that in itself, I think it's a very passive way of resistance. There is an organization created called the Foundation Against Terrorism, who has been putting out lists. They call them hit lists, but it's like notorious, infamous faces of Guatemala. I'm on it, the prosecutor's on it, the American ambassador's on it, the Swedish ambassador's on it. And these are the enemies of Guatemala that have created internationally this rumor that there was genocide. And their claim is that we're not genocidal maniacs. I was like, nobody's saying that Guatemalans are genocidal. They're saying that Rios Montt and a couple of other people, but this is their play on it, right? And they're also writing a lot of Facebook messages, and I have to speak to my kids because they keep saying on the internet that I'm profiting from this and I'm getting going out internationally and getting awards for millions and millions of dollars. And I had to tell my kids, listen, guys, it's not true. So don't think that any of this is true, because it isn't. But nonetheless, it's a constant attack and defamation of anyone that has anything to do with any of this. And that's pretty much how it's being done today.
So you mentioned, I'll ask a quick question and then I'll take yours, Sandra, by the way. You mentioned that in Argentina there has become a movement of survivors and families, and that hasn't yet really hit a tipping point in Guatemala. And I wonder if you could say something about why you think that's the case. But before you answer, let me take a few more questions.
Well, I just wanted to follow up on your comments about Claudia Paz y Paz and what you think is going to happen when she leaves office, and whether you know what she's planning to do next.
And I'll take, yeah, and Carolyn?
Or what your plans are once she is presumably out of office.
Okay. You might have to remind me again.
Okay, those are two pretty separate questions.
But I'll start by answering these. What will happen? We don't know. She's in the process. I read this morning that she was one of the initially contested applicants. In other words, right now they're in a phase where you can contest and accuse the 26 applicants of wrongdoing by anyone, right? So she has been accused of not following the mandate, a sentence of the Inter-American Human Rights Court in a specific case. She's being accused of negligence, of not pursuing the case. And so she will now be allowed to respond. They're going to attack her every day. This Foundation Against Terrorism is going to attack her because her father was a guerrilla fighter, because she's because she's you name it. She's very strong. And I hope she can sustain it. I think she will make it to the final six, not because it's March Madness, say final four, but the final six are, eventually this commission elects six applicants and then passes them to the president. And the president chooses who the attorney general is going to be from the six that he gets passed. If she's not in the six, she's done. She can't be reappointed. If she is in the six, it would be really interesting to see what this president does. Because it's almost, in my view, impossible not to reappoint her. I mean, she was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Look at the results she's getting in every type of case. Unfortunately, also in the cases in the conflict, which is what's going to hurt her. But we don't know. We don't know. That's the truth. We don't know what's going to happen. What can happen is if she's not there, that someone, the idea is to elect the least bad person, the least negative person, the least of the worst, right? And that person will begin to debilitate the human rights section slowly. And that we have done as a community enough work to strengthen them to withstand what's coming. But we don't know. Because what people think is going to happen is that the prosecutor is going to get a raise. He's going to get reappointed with a new position and sent to the middle of nowhere. The new district attorney for Peteng, nothing and no one, but moved out of the human rights section. And probably you can disassemble the whole section that way and put new people that are more in line with the new attorney general's thoughts. The other position there is that we are strong enough as a whole to continue supporting them and continue going. So we presented a project to create a working group with that office to begin to strategize about future cases. What are we going to do? We're going to do exactly what we've done the last 20 years, keep on working. And just, you know, we know that if the way it used to be done before is that we would go to district attorneys instead of the attorney general or instead of the human rights section. That's what we're going to continue doing because they feel the pressure at a local level and they're independent. The attorney general cannot enforce their will on an uncorrupt prosecutor. Prosecutor can do what he feels is right for justice. So there are some good people. So we will just have to, hopefully it doesn't come to that, but we can latch onto them and try to empower them to make sure that they understand they're not alone. And that's where the international community plays a very, very important role. Now,
well, so to continue,
Argentina.
Well, let's continue with what the time frame of what you've just been talking about. So Claudia's term, I think, ends in early May?
Yes.
And so what's the process then? What's the time frame for...
I think the president will be handed within the next month the list of six people. And in April, he will decide in the last days of April. Probably it is believed that during Holy Week, because that's when the important decisions are usually made, either around Christmas time or Holy Week, because nobody's paying attention. Everyone's at the beach. Or... you know, on vacation. Well, actually, usually in Guatemala, people that have money, they usually go to the beach during Christmas, New Year's, or during Holy Week, they do the same thing because they all have beach houses, right? So they're all in the beach. Although those are not the people that they should worry about because probably those are the people that are mandating what's going to happen anyway. But everyone, the whole country is sort of relaxed during those holidays. So usually when very important decisions are made, they're made around the times when nobody's paying attention. The press is also on, you know, everyone has to rest, right? So Holy Week in Guatemala is huge. They call it summer. I was like, summer? It's like a week. Summer is a week. It's not summer, but that's what it's called. So we think it's going to happen around April or May, around those dates. And then the president has a specific time, and then he'll name somebody, and then we'll know. We'll know by the middle of May. And so you're talking about 7 weeks tops. The whole thing will be solved, and we will know.
And on the role of Open Society and also on the role of the United States. So I know that Open Society has been active this last year in Guatemala, supporting some of the human rights groups, supporting some of the independent media, and also trying to awaken some of the groups in the U.S. And throughout Latin America that might be supportive and might advocate for Claudia Paz y Paz to continue her position. What sectors do you think are influential, say, in influencing the president in his decision? Do you think that the U.S. ambassador is influential? We've heard when we've been working in Guatemala that people will say, we want to hear from others in Latin America that all of this uproar is being orchestrated by agents in the United States and that it actually doesn't resonate with people in the continent. Can you comment on those reactions?
Well, I think that this president does confront the wishes of the American government when confronted publicly with them. And we've seen it in a couple of cases. The dam case, apparently there was a restriction of funding for the military because of lack of response in reparation payments to the victims of the dam area, because there was five massacres, people were displaced, and also in adoptions there's been. And initially the president was very, very aggressive in the reaction, and even went after individuals in the American government. Not very smart, but nonetheless, because they still have to negotiate. I mean, I think it's just been a lot of outbursts of stuff that then later have to be subdued somehow. In speaking to the embassy, I think they work quite well with the Guatemalan government. I think something like $200 million is being spent on the fight against drugs and other citizen security issues, gangs and other stuff. So they have to, at some level. Whenever there's this signaling or pointing of specific issues, like in the latest human rights report of State Department, then there's always a backlash from the Guatemalan government saying, wait, that information you used is wrong and we want it fixed because that's wrong. Or when the United Nations presented their last report saying that mano dura, which is strong fist governments, do not work. And that's this government's slogan. It's mano dura. So there was also backlash for that. So I think there's a lot of aggressive reactions from this government that we didn't see before. But overall, at the end of it, I think the American government is extremely influential. And I would continue, I would urge that you know, this is what I say when I speak at university. What can we do? I'll write to your senators and to your congressmen and tell them that you've heard about this work. It's supported by State Department. It's supported by the embassy. It's supported by USAID. That they should keep supporting it. That they don't let the transitional justice issues fall through the cracks just because there's more money in fighting drugs and fighting gangs. And just because that's now sexier as far as financing goes and other issues go. But transitional justice is not a five-year thing. I mean, it's taken us 20 years and we're now only beginning to understand and only beginning to see where the possibility of change is. Yeah, so it's important. As far as hearing from other countries, well, you know, there is, you know, the whole other sectors. This is Scott, by the way, who I was telling you about. And yeah, I think I'm
okay. I'm good with there's a question here, and please introduce yourself as well.
My name is Barl. I'm an attorney at UNDP, and we're actually doing a study on reconciliation in Guatemala, including other countries. And one of the questions I had was sort of related to your first question. What's the role of civil society movement in sort of, you know, getting to reconciliation? Or is there any movement? Are there any organizations that are saying, you know, enough of impunity or enough of staying silent, and sort of if there's anything happening?
Well, you know, there's something, I mean, this something has been happening for a very long time. And there are many. We work with organizations and communities that have become legal representatives of the victims, even though they're not lawyers, and then later hire lawyers sometimes. And they try at a very local level to get communities involved. They're also, most of them, about 14 of these organizations are being financed through UNDP in the PAJUS project, which is the program to accompany transitional justice, which I'm sure you know of, which we're also a part of. Then there's the legal organizations in the city who are stronger but still lack the resources, which is always going to be the issue. They all lack the resources necessary to really do anything other than, you know, scratch the surface. We can see that the difference, for example, Calde H, that was probably giving the Center for Legal Action and Human Rights, which was the, I don't know, what's the legal term for their role in the trial? They were
private,
private prosecutors, they would be called? They would represent, yeah.
They were, right.
They were at the table.
Yeah,
that's what they are, private prosecutors?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they were private prosecutors of the case, and they made all the difference. Because the prosecution, I mean, really, although they've been getting better, there's still a lot to work on. I think the good thing is that there's someone to work with, that they want to do it, and that's a big change from before. But technically speaking, I mean, there's a lot of work to do. And what these organizations, this organization brought in was the technical know-how of how to do it. But even with them, there's a long road ahead. And that's why one of the things that we will be doing is bringing experts down like Almudena and Scott and others to try to learn from the things we've done so we can get better prepared for future cases so that the forensic evidence plays a bigger, more specific role in these convictions and not only sits in the background because it could have been a lot better than it was used. It could have been used a lot better than it was used. So there's other organizations along GAM, FAMDEGUA, CONAVIGUA, among the stronger ones. But again, these are all victims organizations that are created on figureheads that were, you know, GAM was created by Ninette Montenegro, who now is in Congress and wants nothing to do with that. I mean, she does at a personal level, but not with the organization. It is now run by her new husband, Mario, who's great, but he's gone into looking at budget issues a little more and other things. CONAVIGUA, which is Rosalina Tuyuk, who's looking for her father and her husband. We haven't found them, and she was voted out of heading the organization by other members because they started including younger generations, and then there was men, so they wanted somebody younger, and so she's there, but she's not a figure anymore. She's not a figurehead anymore. Then there's FAMDEGUA and Orlena Farfan. She's just old, and she's just been, you know, looking for her brother for the last 30 years. That it just got to her. She's just really, really tired and getting sick. So they're frail organizations that lack the resources to actually, you know, do these huge campaigns. Even the campaign that we do that's sort of big costs us about $15,000-$20,000 a month to do. And that's unheard of. I mean, that's unheard of. Are you investing $15,000-$20 by an NGO and this kind of stuff? And it's nothing. We get nowhere. We like pay for one TV commercial a day in each channel. In 3 years, I saw one commercial. I had to watch like the entire morning. It's like, you know, who are you getting at with that? I mean, there's just not enough. And it's, you know, when I go back, and I always use this, and I'm sorry if you heard it before, but the identification efforts in Guatemala, now our budget is about $3.5 million a year to run everything. That's about a monthly budget of the UN to do this kind of work in Bosnia when we were doing it in Bosnia. So the difference is huge. And we're doing a lot more. But then if you look at it and compare it to the identification efforts for the victims of the World Trade Center, you know how much we spent here? $4 billion. I mean, I'm not saying that we need $4 billion. But I am saying that the process definitely needs an injection. And what it definitely needs is for organizations and governments not to turn away the way they're doing right now. One, because the results are not coming as fast as they think they should be coming. Or two, because it's not trendy. Or three, because there's other problems in the world. I mean, there's always going to be another problem. But it's the same problem, which is one of the things. We're now saying also that we can contribute to looking at these problems in other places. And places like Syria or places like the Central African Republic, where we have some of the answers to the issues that they need. And guess what? We're in the Southern Hemisphere, which is also trendy right now, right? To do South-South cooperation and things of the sort. And it also helps the fact that if Guatemalans can do it, anybody can do it. And, I mean, I know, but it's the truth. It's what people think. We can't do, you know, Guatemalans. I'm going to pour little Guatemalans. Well, some things we can do right. And the idea is to also help other countries go along that road.
Freddie, thank you.
You're welcome.
And an amazing education, both in the general capacity of the field of forensic anthropology as well as the urgency of the application right now. I want to say that OSF Latin America program just authorized an emergency grant to several organizations in Guatemala out of the Reserve Fund for Latin America program, which is a one-time allocation, recognizing that Guatemala really right now is at a crossroads, that there are opportunities, that there is the opportunity opened up by this tremendous work and by the crusading prosecutor and by the Rios Montt trial, but that there is that because of the progress that has been made, there's also been a lot of pushback. So very timely to hear from you. After we conclude, I think you've got some time that you can stay for further questions. So thank you.
My pleasure. Also, just there's some pamphlets up here. They're in English. And initially, We printed them in English because
we made several hundred to take to Los Angeles with us, and then when we got there, we realized, well, we're speaking Spanish everywhere. Why did we do this?
So please take one. It has. This is more or less the information that we give out to families, and it explains the process of what we do and how DNA works. And friend of FAFG is a 501c3 in New York. Scott's the president, and he helped us form it and to exist here at some point with the idea of supporting the work, not only in Guatemala but elsewhere. So take one. So you can take one.
Terrific. Thank you.